This is Audible.
Listening Library presents Flipped by Wendelin Van Dronen. Read for you by Ryan Gazelle and Tara Sands. This is Ryan Gazelle. Diving Under. All I've ever wanted is for Julie Baker to leave me alone. For her to back off, you know? Just give me some space. It all started the summer before second grade when our moving van pulled into her neighborhood. And since we're now about done with the eighth grade, that, my friend, makes more than half a decade of strategic avoidance and social discomfort. She didn't just barge into my life. She barged and shoved and wedged her way into my life. Did we invite her to get into our moving van and start climbing all over boxes? No, but that's exactly what she did, taking over and showing off like only Julie Baker can. My dad tried to stop her. "Hey," he says as she's catapulting herself on board, "what are you doing? You're getting mud everywhere." So true, too. Her shoes were like caked with the stuff. She didn't hop out, though. Instead, she planted her rear end on the floor and started pushing a big box with her feet. "Don't you want some help?" she glanced my way. "It sure looks like you need it." I didn't like the implication, and even though my dad had been tossing me the same sort of look all week, I could tell he didn't like this girl either. "Hey, don't do that," he warned her. "There are some really valuable things in that box." "Oh, well, how about this one?" She scoots over to a box labeled Lennox and looks my way again. "We should push it together." "No, no, no," my dad says, then pulls her up by the arm. "Why don't you run along home? Your mother's probably wondering where you are." This was the beginning of my soon-to-become acute awareness that the girl cannot take a hint. Of any kind. Does she zip on home like a kid should when they've been invited to leave? No. She says, "Oh, my mom knows where I am. She said it was fine." Then she points across the street and says, "We just live right over there." My father looks to where she's pointing and mutters, "Oh boy." Then he looks at me and winks as he says, "Bryce, isn't it time for you to go inside and help your mother?" I knew right off that this was a ditch play, and I didn't think about it until later, but ditch wasn't a play I'd run with my dad before. Face it. Pulling a ditch is not something discussed with dads. It's like against parental law to tell your kid it's okay to ditch someone, no matter how annoying or muddy they might be. But there he was, putting the play in motion, and man, he didn't have to wink twice. I smiled and said, "Sure thing," then jumped off the lift gate and headed for my new front door. I heard her coming after me, but I couldn't believe it. Maybe it just sounded like she was chasing me. Maybe she was really going the other way. But before I got up the nerve to look, she blasted right past me, grabbing my arm and yanking me along. This was too much. I planted myself and was about to tell her to get lost when the weirdest thing happened. I was making this big windmill motion to break away from her, but somehow, on the downswing, my hand wound up tangling into hers. I couldn't believe it. There I was, holding the mud monkey's hand. I tried to shake her off, but she just clamped on tight and yanked me along, saying, "Come on!" My mom came out of the house and immediately got the world's sappiest look on her face. "Well, hello," she says to Julie. "Hi." I'm still trying to pull free, but the girl's got me in a death grip. My mom's grinning, looking at our hands and my fiery red face. "And what's your name, honey?"
"Juliana Baker. I live right over there,"
she says, pointing with her unoccupied hand.
"Well, I see you've met my son," she says, still grinning away.
"Uh-huh."
Finally, I break free and do the only manly thing available when you're 7 years old. I dive behind my mother. Mom puts her arm around me and says, "Bryce, honey, why don't you show Juliana around the house?" I flash her help, and warning signals with every part of my body, but she's not receiving. Then she shakes me off and says, "Go on." Julie would have tramped right in if my mother hadn't noticed her shoes and told her to take them off. And after those were off, my mom told her that her dirty socks had to go too. Julie wasn't embarrassed, not a bit. She just peeled them off and left them in a crusty heap on our porch. I didn't exactly give her a tour. I locked myself in the bathroom instead. And after about 10 minutes of yelling back at her that no, I wasn't coming out anytime soon, things got quiet out in the hall. Another 10 minutes went by before I got the nerve to peek out the door. No Julie. I snuck out and looked around, and yes, she was gone. Not a very sophisticated ditch, but hey, I was only 7. My troubles were far from over, though. Every day she came back, over and over again. "Can Bryce play?" I could hear her asking from my hiding place behind the couch. "Is he ready yet?" One time, she even cut across the yard and looked through my window. I spotted her in the nick of time and dove under my bed, but man, that right there tells you something about Julie Baker. She's got no concept of personal space. No respect for privacy. The world is her playground, and watch out below, Julie's on the slide. Lucky for me, my dad was willing to run block, and he did it over and over again. He told her I was busy or sleeping or just plain gone. He was a lifesaver. My sister, on the other hand, tried to sabotage me any chance she got. Lynetta's like that. She's 4 years older than me, and buddy, I've learned from watching her how not to run your life. She's got antagonize written all over her. Just look at her. Not cross-eyed or with your tongue sticking out or anything. Just look at her, and you've started an argument. I used to knock down, drag out with her, but it's just not worth it. Girls don't fight fair. They pull your hair and gouge you and pinch you. Then they run off gasping to mommy when you try and defend yourself with a fist. Then you get locked into timeout, and for what? No, my friend, the secret is, don't snap at the bait. Let it dangle. Swim around it. Laugh it off. After a while, they'll give up and try to lure someone else. At least that's the way it is with Lynetta. And the bonus of having her as a pain-in-the-rear sister was figuring out that this method works on everyone. Teachers, jerks at school, even mom and dad. Seriously, there's no winning arguments with your parents, so why get all pumped up over them? It is way better to dive down and get out of the way than it is to get clobbered by some parental tidal wave. The funny thing is, Lynetta's still clueless when it comes to dealing with mom and dad. She goes straight into thrash mode, and is too busy drowning in the argument to take a deep breath and dive for calmer water. And she thinks I'm stupid. Anyway, true to form, Lynetta tried to bait me with Julie those first few days. She even snuck her past Dad once and marched her all around the house, hunting me down. I wedged myself up on the top shelf of my closet, and lucky for me, neither of them looked up. A few minutes later, I heard Dad yell at Julie to get off the antique furniture, and once again, she got booted. I don't think I went outside that whole first week. I helped unpack stuff and watch TV and just kind of hung around while my mom and dad arranged and rearranged the furniture, debating whether Empire settees and French Rococo tables should even be put in the same room. So believe me, I was dying to go outside, but every time I checked through the window, I could see Julie showing off in her yard. She'd be heading a soccer ball or doing high kicks with it or dribbling it up and down their driveway. And when she wasn't busy showing off, she'd just sit on the curb with the ball between her feet, staring at our house. My mom didn't understand why it was so awful that that cute little girl had held my hand. She thought I should make friends with her.
I thought you liked soccer, honey. Why don't you go out there and kick the ball around?
Because I didn't want to be kicked around, that's why. And although I couldn't say it like that at the time, I still had enough sense at age 7 and a half to know that Julie Baker was dangerous. Unavoidably dangerous, as it turns out. The minute I walked into Mrs. Yelson's second grade classroom, I was dead meat.
Bryce! Julie squeals. You're here!
Then she charges across the room and tackles me. Mrs. Yelson tried to explain this attack away as a welcome hug, but man, that was no hug. That was a front-line, take-em-down tackle. And even though I shook her off, it was too late. I was branded for life. Everyone jeered.
Where's your girlfriend, Bryce? Are you married yet, Bryce?
And then when she chased me around at recess and tried to lay kisses on me, the whole school started singing,
Bryce and Julie sitting in a tree, K-I-S-S-I-N-G.
My first year in town was a disaster. Third grade wasn't much better. She was still hot on my trail every time I turned around. Same with fourth. But then, in fifth grade, I took action. It started out slow, one of those, nah, that's not the right ideas you get and forget. But the more I played with the idea, the more I thought, what better way to ward Julie off? What better way to say to her, Julie, you are not my type? And so, my friend, I hatched the plan. I asked Shelley Stalls out. To fully appreciate the brilliance of this, you have to understand that Julie hates Shelley Stalls. She always has, though it beats me why. Shelley's nice, and she's friendly, and she's got a lot of hair. What's not to like? But Julie hated her, and I was going to make this little gem of knowledge the solution to my problem. What I was thinking was that Shelley would eat lunch at our table and maybe walk around a little with me. That way, anytime Julie was around, all I'd have to do was hang a little closer to Shelley and things would just naturally take care of themselves. What happened, though, is that Shelley took things way too seriously. She went around telling everybody, including Julie, that we were in love. In no time, Julie and Shelley got into some kind of cat fight, and while Shelley was recovering from that, my supposed friend Garrett, who had been totally behind this plan, told her what I was up to. He's always denied it, but I've since learned that his code of honor is easily corrupted by weepy females. That afternoon, the principal tried cross-examining me, but I wouldn't cop to anything. I just kept telling her that I was sorry and that I really didn't understand what had happened. Finally, she let me go. Shelley cried for days and followed me around school sniffling and making me feel like a real jerk, which was even worse than having Julie as a shadow. Everything blew over at the 1 week mark, though, when Shelley officially dumped me and started going out with Kyle Larson. Then Julie started up with the goo-goo eyes again, and I was back to square one. Now, in sixth grade, things changed, though whether they improved is hard to say. I don't remember Julie actually chasing me in the sixth grade, but I do remember her sniffing me. Yes, my friend, I said sniffing. And you can blame that on our teacher, Mr. Mertens. He stuck Julie to me like glue. Mr. Mertens has got some kind of doctorate in seating arrangements or something because he analyzed and scrutinized and practically baptized the seats we had to sit in. And of course, he decided to seat Julie right next to me. Julie Baker is the kind of annoying person who makes a point of letting you know she's smart. Her hand is the first one up. Her answers are usually complete dissertations. Her projects are always turned in early and used as weapons against the rest of the class. Teachers always have to hold her project up and say, "This is what I'm looking for, class. This is an example of A-plus work."
Add all the extra credit she does to an already perfect score, and I swear she's never gotten less than 120% in any subject. But after Mr. Merton stuck Julie right next to me, her annoying knowledge of all subjects far and wide came in handy. See, suddenly Julie's perfect answers, written in perfect cursive, were right across the aisle, just an eye shot away. You wouldn't believe the number of answers I snagged from her. I started getting A's and B's on everything. It was great. But then Mr. Merton's pulled the shift. He had some new idea for optimizing positional latitude and longitude. And when the dust finally settled, I was sitting right in front of Julie Baker. This is where the sniffing comes in. That maniac started leaning forward and sniffing my hair. She'd edge her nose practically up to my scalp and sniff, sniff, sniff. I tried elbowing and back kicking. I tried scooting my chair way forward or putting my backpack between me and the seat. Nothing helped. She'd just scoot up too or lean over a little farther and sniff, sniff, sniff. I finally asked Mr. Merton's to move me, but he wouldn't do it. Something about not wanting to disturb the delicate balance of educational energies. Whatever. I was stuck with her sniffing. And since I couldn't see her perfectly penned answers anymore, my grades took a dive. Especially in spelling. Then, one time, during a test, Julie's in the middle of sniffing my hair when she notices that I've blown a spelling word. A lot of words. Suddenly, the sniffing stops, and the whispering starts. At first, I couldn't believe it. Julie Baker cheating? But sure enough, she was spelling words for me, right in my ear. Julie'd always been sly about sniffing, which really bugged me because no one ever noticed her doing it. But she was just as sly about giving me answers, which was okay by me. The bad thing about it was that I started counting on her spelling in my ear. I mean, why study when you don't have to, right? But after a while, taking all those answers made me feel sort of indebted to her. How can you tell someone to bug off or quit sniffing you when you owe them? It's, you know, wrong. So, I spent the sixth grade somewhere between uncomfortable and unhappy. But I kept thinking that next year, things would be different. We'd be in junior high, a big school, in different classes. It would be a world with too many people to worry about ever seeing Julie Baker again. It was finally, going to be over.
Flipped. The first day I met Bryce Lasky, I flipped. Honestly, one look at him and I became a lunatic. It's his eyes. Something in his eyes. They're blue, and framed in the blackness of his lashes, they're dazzling. Absolutely breathtaking. It's been over 6 years now, and I learned long ago to hide my feelings, but oh, those first days, those first years, I thought I would die for wanting to be with him. 2 days before the second grade is when it started. Although the anticipation began weeks before, ever since my mother had told me that there was a family with a boy my age moving into the new house right across the street. Soccer camp had ended, and I'd been so bored because there was nobody, absolutely nobody, in the neighborhood to play with. Oh, there were kids, but every one of them was older. That was dandy for my brothers, but what it left me was home alone. My mother was there, but she had better things to do than kick a soccer ball around. So she said, anyway. At the time, I didn't think there was anything better than kicking a soccer ball around. Especially not the likes of laundry or dishes or vacuuming. But my mother didn't agree. And the danger of being home alone with her was that she'd recruit me to help her wash or dust or vacuum. And she wouldn't tolerate the dribbling of a soccer ball around the house as I moved from chore to chore. To play it safe, I waited outside for weeks, just in case the new neighbors moved in early. Literally, it was weeks. I entertained myself by playing soccer with our dog, Champ. Mostly, he'd just block because a dog can't exactly kick and score, but once in a while, he'd dribble with his nose. The scent of a ball must overwhelm a dog, though, because Champ would eventually try to chomp it, then lose the ball to me. When the Lasky's moving van finally arrived, everyone in my family was happy. Little Juliana was finally going to have a playmate. My mother, being the truly sensible adult that she is, made me wait more than an hour before going over to meet him. "Give them a chance to stretch their legs, Juliana," she said. "They'll want some time to adjust." She wouldn't even let me watch from the yard. "I know you, sweetheart. Somehow that ball will wind up in their yard and you'll just have to go retrieve it." So I watched from the window, and every few minutes I'd ask, "Now?" And she'd say, "Give them a little while longer, would you?" Then the phone rang, and the minute I was sure she was good and preoccupied, I tugged on her sleeve and asked, "Now?" She nodded and whispered, "Okay, but take it easy. I'll be over there in a minute." I was too excited not to charge across the street, but I did try very hard to be civilized once I got to the moving van. I stood outside looking in for a record-breaking length of time, which was hard because there he was, about halfway back. My new sure-to-be best friend, Bryce Lasky. Bryce wasn't really doing much of anything. He was more hanging back, watching his father move boxes onto the liftgate. I remember feeling sorry for Mr. Lasky, because he looked worn out moving boxes all by himself. I also remember that he and Bryce were wearing matching turquoise polo shirts, which I thought was really cute. Really nice. When I couldn't stand it any longer, I called, "Hi!" into the van, which made Bryce jump. And then, quick as a cricket, he started pushing a box like he'd been working all along. I could tell from the way Bryce was acting so guilty that he was supposed to be moving boxes, but he was sick of it. He'd probably been moving things for days. It was easy to see that he needed a rest. He needed some juice, something. It was also easy to see that Mr. Lasky wasn't about to let him quit. He was going to keep on moving boxes around until he collapsed, and by then Bryce might be dead. Dead before he'd had the chance to move in. The tragedy of it catapulted me into the moving van. I had to help. I had to save him. When I got to his side to help him shove a box forward, the poor boy was so exhausted that he just moved aside and let me take over. Mr. Lasky didn't want me to help, but at least I saved Bryce. I'd been in the moving van all of 3 minutes when his dad sent him off to help his mother unpack things inside the house. I chased Bryce up the walkway, and that's when everything changed. You see, I caught up to him and grabbed his arm, trying to stop him so maybe we could play a little before he got trapped inside. And the next thing I know, he's holding my hand, looking right into my eyes. My heart stopped. It just stopped beating. And for the first time in my life, I had that feeling. You know, like the world is moving all around you, all beneath you, all inside you, and you're floating, floating in midair. And the only thing keeping you from drifting away is the other person's eyes. They're connected to yours by some invisible physical force, and they hold you fast while the rest of the world swirls and twirls and falls completely away. I almost got my first kiss that day. I'm sure of it. But then his mother came out the front door, and he was so embarrassed that his cheeks turned completely red, and the next thing you know, he's hiding in the bathroom. I was waiting for him to come out when his sister, Lynetta, saw me in the hallway. She seemed big and mature to me, and since she wanted to know what was going on, I told her a little bit about it. I shouldn't have, though, because she wiggled the bathroom doorknob and started teasing Bryce something fierce. "Hey, baby brother," she called through the door. "There's a hot chick out here waiting for you. What's the matter? Afraid she's got cooties?" It was so embarrassing. I yanked on her arm and told her to stop it, but she wouldn't. So finally, I just left. I found my mother outside talking to Mrs. Lasky. Mom had given her the beautiful lemon bundt cake that was supposed to be our dessert that night. The powdered sugar looked soft and white, and the cake was still warm, sending sweet lemon smells into the air. My mouth was watering just looking at it. But it was in Mrs. Lasky's hands, and I knew there was no getting it back. All I could do was try to eat up the smells while I listened to the two of them discuss grocery stores and the weather forecast. After that, Mom and I went home. It was very strange. I hadn't gotten to play with Bryce at all. All I knew was that his eyes were a dizzying blue, that he had a sister who was not to be trusted, and that he'd almost kissed me. I fell asleep that night thinking about the kiss that might have been. What did a kiss feel like anyway? Somehow I knew it wouldn't be like the one I got from Mom or Dad at bedtime. The same species maybe, but a radically different beast to be sure. Like a wolf and a whippet. Only science would put them on the same tree. Looking back on the second grade, I like to think it was at least partly scientific curiosity that made me chase after that kiss, but to be honest, it was probably more those blue eyes. All through the second and third grades, I couldn't seem to stop myself from following him, from sitting by him, from just wanting to be near him. By the fourth grade, I'd learned to control myself. The sight of him, the thought of him, still sent my heart humming. But my legs didn't actually chase after him anymore. I just watched and thought and dreamed. Then, in the fifth grade, Shelley Stahls came into the picture. Shelley Stahls is a ninny. A whiny, gossipy, backstabbing ninny who says one thing to one person and the opposite to another. Now that we're in junior high, she's the undisputed diva of drama. But even back in elementary school, she knew how to put on a performance. Especially when it came to PE. I never once saw her run laps or do calisthenics. Instead, she would go into her delicate act, claiming her body would absolutely collapse from the strain if she ran or jumped or stretched. It worked. Every year. She'd bring in some note and be sure to swoon a little for the teacher the first few days of the year, after which she'd be excused from anything that required muscles. She never even put up her own chair at the end of the day. The only muscles she exercised regularly were the ones around her mouth, and those she worked out nonstop. If there was an Olympic contest for talking, Shelley Stahls would sweep the event. Well, she'd at least win the gold and silver. One medal for each side of her mouth. What bugged me about it was not the fact that she got out of PE. Who'd want her on their team anyway? What bugged me about it was that anyone who bothered to look would know that it wasn't asthma or weak ankles or her being delicate that was stopping her. It was her hair. She had mountains of it, twisted this way or that, clipped or beaded, braided or swirled. Her ponytails rivaled the ones on carousel horses. And on the days she let it all hang down, she'd sort of shimmy and cuddle inside it like it was a blanket, so that practically all you saw of her face was her nose. Good luck playing four square with a blanket over your head. My solution to Shelley Stahls was to ignore her, which worked just dandy until about halfway through the fifth grade when I saw her holding hands with Bryce. My Bryce, the one who was still embarrassed over holding my hand 2 days before the second grade, the one who was still too shy to say much more than hello to me, the one who was still walking around with my first kiss. How could Shelley have wormed her hand into his? That pushy little princess had no business hanging on to him like that. Bryce looked over his shoulder from time to time as they walked along, and he was looking at me. My first thought was that he was telling me he was sorry. Then it dawned on me. He needed my help. Absolutely, that's what it had to be. Shelley Stahls was too delicate to shake off, too swirly to be pushed away. She'd unravel and start sniffling, and oh, how embarrassing that would be for him. No, this wasn't a job a boy could do gracefully. This was a job for a girl. I didn't even bother checking around for other candidates. I had her off of him in 2 seconds flat. Bryce ran away the minute he was free, but not Shelley. Oh, no, no, no. She came at me, scratching and pulling and twisting anything she could get her hands on, telling me that Bryce was hers, and there was no way she was letting him go. How delicate. I was hoping for herds of teachers to appear so they could see the real Shelley Stalls in action. But it was too late by the time anyone arrived on the scene. I had Fluffy in a headlock, and her arm twisted back in a hammerlock, and no amount of her squawking or scratching was going to get me to unlock her until a teacher arrived. In the end, Shelley went home early with a bad case of mussed-up hair, while I told my side of things to the principal. Mrs. Schultz is a sturdy lady who probably secretly appreciates the value of a swift kick well-placed. And although she told me that it would be better if I let other people work out their own dilemmas, she definitely understood about Shelley Stalls and her hair, and told me she was glad I'd had the self-control to do nothing more than restrain her. Shelley was back the next day with a head full of braids. And of course, she got everybody whispering about me. But I just ignored them. The facts spoke for themselves. Bryce didn't go anywhere near her for the rest of the year. That's not to say that Bryce held my hand after that. But he did start being a little friendlier to me, especially in the sixth grade, after Mr. Mertens sat us right next to each other in the third row back. Sitting next to Bryce was nice. He was nice. He'd say, "Hi, Julie," to me every morning. And once in a while, I'd catch him looking my way. He'd always blush and go back to his own work, and I couldn't help but smile. He was so shy and so cute. We talked to each other more, too, especially after Mr. Mertens moved me behind him. Mr. Mertens had a detention policy about spelling where if you missed more than 7 out of 25 words, you had to spend lunch inside with him, writing your words over and over and over again. The pressure of detention made Bryce panic, and even though it bothered my conscience, I'd lean in and whisper answers to him, hoping that maybe I could spend lunch with him instead. His hair smelled like watermelon, and his earlobes had fuzz, soft blonde fuzz, and I wondered about that. How does a boy with such black hair wind up with blonde ear fuzz? What's it doing there anyway? I checked my own earlobes in the mirror, but couldn't find much of anything on them, and I didn't spot any on other people's either. I thought about asking Mr. Mertens about earlobe fuzz when we were discussing evolution in science, but I didn't. Instead, I spent the year whispering spelling words, sniffing watermelon, and wondering if I was ever going to get my kiss.
Buddy, beware. Seventh grade brought changes, all right, but the biggest one didn't happen at school. It happened at home. Granddad Duncan came to live with us. At first, it was kind of weird because none of us really knew him, except for Mom, of course, and even though she's spent the past year and a half trying to convince us he's a great guy, from what I can tell, the thing he likes to do best is stare out the front room window. There's not much to see out there except the baker's front yard, but you can find him there day or night, sitting in the big easy chair they moved in with him, staring out the window. Okay. So he also reads Tom Clancy novels and the newspapers and does crossword puzzles and tracks his stocks, but those things are all distractions. Given no one to justify it to, the man would stare out the window until he fell asleep. Not that there's anything wrong with that. It just seems so boring. Mom says he stares like that because he misses Grandma, but that's not something Granddad had ever discussed with me. As a matter of fact, he never discussed much of anything with me until a few months ago when he read about Julie in the newspaper. Now, Julie Baker did not wind up on the front page of the Mayfield Times for being an eighth grade Einstein, like you might suspect. No, my friend, she got front page coverage because she refused to climb out of a sycamore tree. Not that I could tell a sycamore from a maple or a birch for that matter, but Julie, of course, knew what kind of tree it was and passed that knowledge along to every creature in her wake. So this tree, this sycamore tree, was up the hill on a vacant lot on Collier Street, and it was massive. Massive and ugly. It was twisted and gnarled and bent, and I kept expecting the thing to blow over in the wind. One day last year, I'd finally had enough of her yakking about that stupid tree. I came right out and told her that it was not a magnificent sycamore. It was, in reality, the ugliest tree known to man. And you know what she said? She said I was visually challenged. Visually challenged. This from the girl who lives in a house that's the scourge of the neighborhood. They've got bushes growing over windows, weeds sticking out all over the place, and a barnyard's worth of animals running wild. I'm talking dogs, cats, chickens, even snakes. I swear to God, her brothers have a boa constrictor in their room. They dragged me in there when I was about 10 and made me watch it eat a rat. A live, beady-eyed rat. They held that rodent up by its tail and gulp, the boa swallowed it whole. That snake gave me nightmares for a month. Anyway, normally, I wouldn't care about someone's yard, but the baker's mess bugged my dad big time, and he channeled his frustration into our yard. He said it was our neighborly duty to show them what a yard's supposed to look like. So while Mike and Matt are busy plumping up their boa, I'm having to mow and edge our yard, then sweep the walkways and gutter, which is going a little overboard if you ask me. And you'd think Julie's dad, who's a big, strong, brick-laying dude, would fix the place up. But no. According to my mom, he spends all his free time painting. His landscapes don't seem like anything special to me, but judging by his price tags, he thinks quite a lot of them. We see them every year at the Mayfield County Fair, and my parents always say the same thing. The world would have more beauty in it if he'd fix up the yard instead. Mom and Julie's mom do talk some. I think my mom feels sorry for Mrs. Baker. She says she married a dreamer, and because of that, one of the two of them will always be unhappy. Whatever. Maybe Julie's aesthetic sensibilities have been permanently screwed up by her father, and none of this is her fault. But Julie has always thought that that sycamore tree was God's gift to our little corner of the universe. Back in the third and fourth grades, she used to clown around with her brothers in the branches or peel big chunks of bark off so they could slide down the crook in its trunk. It seemed like they were playing in it whenever my mom took us somewhere in the car. Julie'd be swinging from the branches, ready to fall and break every bone in her body, while we were waiting at the stoplight, and my mom would shake her head and say, "Don't you ever climb that tree like that. Do you hear me, Bryce? I never want to see you doing that. You either, Lynetta. That is much too dangerous." My sister would roll her eyes and say, "As if," while I'd slump beneath the window and pray for the light to change before Julie squealed my name for the world to hear. I did try to climb it once in the fifth grade. It was the day after Julie had rescued my kite from its mutant, toy-eating foliage. She climbed miles up to get my kite, and when she came down, she was actually very cool about it. She didn't hold my kite hostage and stick her lips out like I was afraid she might. She just handed it over and then backed away. I was relieved, but I also felt like a weenie. When I'd seen where my kite was trapped, I was sure it was a goner. Not Julie. She scrambled up and got it down in no time. Man, it was embarrassing. So I made a mental picture of how high she'd climbed, and the next day, I set off to outdo her by at least two branches. I made it past the crook, up a few limbs, and then, just to see how I was doing, I looked down. Mistake! It felt like I was on top of the Empire State Building without a bungee. I tried looking up to where my kite had been, but it was hopeless. I was indeed a tree-climbing weenie. Then junior high started, and my dream of a Julie-free existence shattered. I had to take the bus, and you know who did, too. There were about 8 kids altogether at our bus stop, which created a buffer zone, but it was no comfort zone. Julie always tried to stand beside me or talk to me or in some other way mortify me. And then she started climbing. The girl is in the 7th grade and she's climbing a tree. Way, way up in a tree. And why does she do it? So she can yell down at us that the bus is 5, 4, 3 blocks away. Blow-by-blow traffic watch from a tree. What every kid in junior high feels like hearing first thing in the morning. She tried to get me to come up there with her, too. Bryce, come on. You won't believe the colors. It's absolutely magnificent. Bryce, you've got to come up here. Yeah, I could just hear it. Bryce and Julie sitting in a tree. Was I ever going to leave the 2nd grade behind? One morning, I was specifically not looking up when out of nowhere, she swings down from a branch and practically knocks me over. Heart attack. I dropped my backpack and wrenched my neck, and that did it. I refused to wait under that tree with that maniac monkey on the loose anymore. I started leaving the house at the very last minute. I made up my own waiting spot, and when I'd see the bus pull up, I'd truck up the hill and get on board. No Julie, no problem. And that, my friend, took care of the rest of 7th grade and almost all of 8th too. Until one day, a few months ago. That's when I heard a commotion up the hill and could see some big trucks parked up on Collier Street where the bus pulls in. There were some men shouting stuff up at Julie, who was, of course, 5 stories up in the tree. All the other kids started to gather under the tree, too, and I could hear them telling her she had to come down. She was fine. That was obvious to anyone with a pair of ears, but I couldn't figure out what they were all arguing about. I trucked up the hill, and as I got closer and saw what the men were holding, I figured out in a hurry what was making Julie refuse to come out of the tree. Chainsaws. Don't get me wrong here, okay? The tree was an ugly, mutant tangle of gnarly branches. The girl arguing with those men was Julie, the world's peskiest, bossiest, most know-it-all female. But all of a sudden, my stomach completely bailed on me. Julie loved that tree. Stupid as it was, she loved that tree. And cutting it down would be like cutting out her heart. Everyone tried to talk her down, even me. But she said she wasn't coming down, not ever. And then she tried to talk us up. Bryce, please, come up here with me. They won't cut it down if we're all up here. For a second, I considered it. But then the bus arrived and I talked myself out of it. It wasn't my tree. And even though she acted like it was, it wasn't Julie's either. We boarded the bus and left her behind. But school was pretty much a waste. I couldn't seem to stop thinking about Julie. Was she still up in the tree? Were they going to arrest her? When the bus dropped us off that afternoon, Julie was gone, and so was half the tree. The top branches, the place my kite had been stuck, her favorite perch. They were all gone. We watched them work for a little while, the chainsaws gunning at full throttle, smoking as they chewed through wood. The tree looked lopsided and naked, and after a few minutes I had to get out of there. It was like watching someone dismember a body, and for the first time in ages, I felt like crying. Crying. Over a stupid tree that I hated. I went home and tried to shake it off, but I kept wondering, should I have gone up the tree with her? Would it have done any good? I thought about calling Julie to tell her I was sorry they'd cut it down, but I didn't. It would have been too, I don't know, weird. She didn't show at the bus stop the next morning. And didn't ride the bus home that afternoon either. Then that night, right before dinner, my grandfather summoned me into the front room. He didn't call to me as I was walking by. That would have bordered on friendliness. What he did was talk to my mother, who talked to me.
I don't know what it's about, honey, she said. Maybe he's just ready to get to know you a little better.
Great. The man's had a year and a half to get acquainted, and he chooses now to get to know me. But I couldn't exactly blow him off. My grandfather's a big man, with a meaty nose and greased back, salt and pepper hair. He lives in house slippers and a sports coat, and I've never seen a whisker on him. They grow, but he shaves them off like 3 times a day. It's a real recreational activity for him. Besides his meaty nose, he's also got big, meaty hands. I suppose you'd notice his hands regardless, but what makes you realize just how beefy they are is his wedding ring. That thing's never going to come off. And even though my mother says that's how it should be, I think he ought to get it cut off. Another few pounds and that ring's going to amputate his finger. When I went in to see him, those big hands of his were woven together resting on the newspaper in his lap. I said, Granddad, you wanted to see me?
Have a seat, son.
Son? Half the time he didn't seem to know who I was, and now suddenly I was son? I sat in the chair opposite him and waited.
Tell me about your friend, Julie Baker.
Julie? She's not exactly my friend.
Why is that?
He asked, calmly, like he had prior knowledge. I started to justify it, then stopped myself and asked, Why do you want to know? He opened the paper and pressed down the crease, and that's when I realized that Julie Baker had made the front page of the Mayfield Times. There was a huge picture of her in the tree, surrounded by a fire brigade and policemen, and then some smaller photos I couldn't make out very well. Can I see that? He folded it up, but didn't hand it over.
Why isn't she your friend, Bryce?
Because she's... I shook my head and said, You'd have to know Julie.
I'd like to.
What? Why?
Because the girl's got an iron backbone. Why don't you invite her over sometime?
An iron backbone? Granddad, you don't understand. That girl is a royal pain. She's a show-off. She's a know-it-all. And she is pushy beyond belief.
Is that so?
Yes, that's absolutely so. And she's been stalking me since the second grade. He frowned, then looked out the window and asked,
They've lived there that long?
I think they were all born there. He frowned some more before he looked back at me and said,
A girl like that doesn't live next door to everyone, you know.
Lucky them. He studied me, long and hard. I said, What? But he didn't flinch. He just kept staring at me. And I couldn't take it. I had to look away. Keep in mind that this was the first real conversation I'd had with my grandfather. This was the first time he'd made the effort to talk to me about something besides passing the salt. And does he want to get to know me? No. He wants to know about Julie. I couldn't just stand up and leave, even though that's what I felt like doing. Somehow I knew if I left like that, he'd quit talking to me at all, even about salt. So I sat there, feeling sort of tortured. Was he mad at me? How could he be mad at me? I hadn't done anything wrong. When I looked up, he was sitting there, holding out the newspaper to me.
Read this, he said, without prejudice.
I took it, and when he went back to looking out the window, I knew I'd been dismissed. By the time I got down to my room, I was mad. I slammed my bedroom door and flopped down on the bed, and after fuming about my sorry excuse for a grandfather for a while, I shoved the newspaper in the bottom drawer of my desk, like I needed to know any more about Julie Baker. At dinner, my mother asked me why I was so sulky, and she kept looking from me to my grandfather. Granddad didn't seem to need any salt, which was a good thing because I might have thrown the shaker at him. My sister and Dad were all business as usual, though. Lynetta ate about 2 raisins out of her carrot salad, then peeled the skin and meat off her chicken wing and nibbled gristle off the bone, while my father filled up airspace talking about office politics and the need for a shakedown in upper management. No one was listening to him. No one ever does when he gets on one of his "if I ran the circus" jags. But for once, Mom wasn't even pretending. And for once, she wasn't trying to convince Lynetta that dinner was delicious either. She just kept eyeing me and Granddad, trying to pick up on why we were miffed at each other. Not that he had anything to be miffed at me about. What had I done to him anyway? Nothing. Nada. But he was. I could tell. And I completely avoided looking at him until about halfway through dinner when I sneaked a peek. He was studying me all right, and even though it wasn't a mean stare or a hard stare, it was, you know, firm, steady. And it weirded me out. What was his deal? I didn't look at him again, or at my mother. I just went back to eating and pretended to listen to my dad. And the first chance I got, I excused myself and holed up in my room. I was planning to call my friend Garrett like I usually do when I'm bent about something. I even punched in his number. But I don't know. I just hung up. And later, when my mom came in, I faked like I was sleeping. I haven't done that in years. The whole night was weird like that. I just wanted to be left alone. Julie wasn't at the bus stop the next morning, or Friday morning. She was at school, but you'd never know it if you didn't actually look. She didn't whip her hand through the air trying to get the teacher to call on her or charge through the halls getting to class. She didn't make unsolicited comments for the teacher's edification or challenge the kids who took cuts in the milk line. She just sat. Quiet. I told myself I should be glad about it. It was like she wasn't even there, and isn't that what I'd always wanted? But still, I felt bad. About her tree. About how she hurried off to eat by herself in the library at lunch. About how her eyes were red around the edges. I wanted to tell her, "Man, I'm sorry about your sycamore tree." But the words never seemed to come out. By the middle of the next week, they'd finished taking down the tree. They cleared the lot and even tried to pull up the stump, but that sucker would not budge, so they wound up grinding it down into the dirt. Julie still didn't show at the bus stop. And by the end of the week, I learned from Garrett that she was riding a bike. He said he'd seen her on the side of the road twice that week, putting the chain back on the derailleur of a rusty old 10-speed. I figured she'd be back. It was a long ride out to Mayfield Junior High, and once she got over the tree, she'd start riding the bus again. I even caught myself looking for her. Not on the lookout, just looking. Then one day, it rained, and I thought for sure she'd be up at the bus stop. But no. Garrett said he saw her trucking along on her bike in a bright yellow poncho, and in math I noticed that her pants were still soaked from the knees down. When math let out, I started to chase after her to tell her that she ought to try riding the bus again, but I stopped myself in the nick of time. What was I thinking? That Julie wouldn't take a little friendly concern and completely misinterpret it? Whoa now, buddy, beware. Better to just leave well enough alone. After all, the last thing I needed was for Julie Baker to think I missed her.
The sycamore tree. I love to watch my father paint. Or really, I love to hear him talk while he paints. The words always come out soft, and somehow heavy when he's brushing on the layers of a landscape. Not sad. Weary, maybe, but peaceful. My father doesn't have a studio or anything, and since the garage is stuffed with things that everyone thinks they need but no one ever uses, He paints outside. Outside is where the best landscapes are, only they're nowhere near our house. So what he does is keep a camera in his truck. His job as a mason takes him to lots of different locations, and he's always on the lookout for a great sunrise or sunset, or even just a nice field with sheep or cows. Then he picks out one of the snapshots, clips it to his easel, and paints. The paintings come out fine, but I've always felt a little sorry for him, having to paint beautiful scenes in our backyard, which is not exactly picturesque. It never was much of a yard, but after I started raising chickens, things didn't exactly improve. Dad doesn't seem to see the backyard or the chickens when he's painting, though. It's not just the snapshot or the canvas he sees either. It's something much bigger. He gets this look in his eye like he's transcended the yard, the neighborhood, the world, and as his big calloused hands sweep a tiny brush against the canvas, it's almost like his body has been possessed by some graceful spiritual being. When I was little, my dad would let me sit beside him on the porch while he painted, as long as I'd be quiet. I don't do quiet easily, but I discovered that after 5 or 10 minutes without a peep, he'd start talking. I've learned a lot about my dad that way. He told me all sorts of stories about what he'd done when he was my age, and other things too, like how he got his first job delivering hay, and how he wished he'd finished college. When I got a little older, he still talked about himself and his childhood, but he also started asking questions about me. What were we learning at school? What book was I currently reading? What did I think about this or that? Then, one time, he surprised me and asked me about Bryce. Why was I so crazy about Bryce? I told him about his eyes and his hair and the way his cheeks blush. But I don't think I explained it very well because when I was done, Dad shook his head and told me in soft, heavy words that I needed to start looking at the whole landscape. I didn't really know what he meant by that, but it made me want to argue with him. How could he possibly understand about Bryce? He didn't know him. But this was not an arguing spot. Those were scattered throughout the house, but not out here. We were both quiet for a record-breaking amount of time before he kissed me on the forehead and said, "Proper lighting is everything, Juliana." Proper lighting? What was that supposed to mean? I sat there wondering, but I was afraid that by asking, I'd be admitting that I wasn't mature enough to understand, and for some reason it felt obvious, like I should understand. After that, he didn't talk so much about events as he did about ideas. And the older I got, the more philosophical he seemed to get. I don't know if he really got more philosophical or if he just thought I could handle it now that I was in the double digits. Mostly, the things he talked about floated around me, but once in a while, something would happen, and I would understand exactly what he had meant.
"A painting is more than the sum of its parts,"
he would tell me, and then go on to explain how the cow by itself is just a cow, and the meadow by itself is just grass and flowers, and the sun peeking through the trees is just a beam of light, but put them all together, and you've got magic. I understood what he was saying, but I never felt what he was saying until one day when I was up in the sycamore tree. The sycamore tree had been at the top of the hill forever. It was on a big vacant lot, giving shade in the summer and a place for birds to nest in the spring. It had a built-in slide for us, too. Its trunk bent up and around in almost a complete spiral, and it was so much fun to ride down. My mom told me she thought the tree must have been damaged as a sapling, but survived. And now, maybe 100 years later, it was still there, the biggest tree she'd ever seen.
"A testimony to endurance," is what she called it.
I had always played in the tree, but I didn't become a serious climber until the 5th grade. When I went up to rescue a kite that was stuck in its branches. I'd first spotted the kite floating free through the air, and then saw it dive bomb somewhere up the hill by the sycamore tree. I've flown kites before, and I know sometimes they're gone forever, And sometimes, they're just waiting in the middle of the road for you to rescue them. Kites can be lucky, or they can be ornery. I've had both kinds, and a lucky kite is definitely worth chasing after. This kite looked lucky to me. It wasn't anything fancy, just an old-fashioned diamond with blue and yellow stripes.